Okay, and then thank you so much. And just a reminder for all our online attendees, you can also post your questions in the online Q&A so that we can pass them on to the speakers. Our next topic for the day is categorical data for pricing, so another pricing topic. And I don't think our speaker actually needs introduction, but for those of you that do not know Ron Richmond is Chief Actuary at Old Mutual Insure, where he's responsible for oversight of all actuarial activities in the OMI Group. He's a Fellow of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries and the Actuarial Society of South Africa, holding practicing certificates in both short-term insurance and life insurance. He also holds a Master's of Philosophy in Actuarial Science with distinction from the University of Cape Town. He chairs the Actuarial Society of South Africa's Climate Change Committee and is the Vice Chair of the Aston Board. Thanks so much, Ron. We appreciate you making time for us today.
Thank you very much, and my sincere apology. My apologies that I'm not there in person. It has been a crazy day, and I just could not get there. So I hope the online presence will suffice. Thank you very much to the STIC also for kindly allowing me to present today. This is a topic we've been working on for about 18 months now, and I hope it will be really interesting for those of you in pricing, but also those of you involved in other disciplines like reserving, where categorical data such as line of business are, you have them everywhere, and some of the methods can also be applied there. So I want to give a little bit of background. This presentation is based on joint work with Mario Wittrich from ETH in Zurich. And this paper is called High Cardinality Categorical Covariates in Network Regression. So you can get the paper for free from the link on the slide. And also you're welcome to download the code to reproduce the results from GitHub. So it's all fully open source and available. So what are we going to do in this talk? So I'd like to introduce some methods for dealing with categorical data through a technique called embeddings in the deep learning literature. And this will be in particular for categorical variables with high cardinality. So for example, think of regions in South Africa. There's probably upwards of 500. Or if you think of motor vehicle makes, again, something where you might have upwards of 500 in reality. And it can be very difficult to incorporate these high cardinality categorical embeddings or high cardinality categorical data into your models. And that's really because you have a lot of levels that don't have much exposure. And we'll be showing how can you use regularization and credibility methods in a way so that we can actually get credibility from all of these categorical variables. We're going to discuss then also how do you deal with categories that have a natural hierarchy. So for example, think of motor brand versus motor model. Those live in a sort of natural hierarchy, and we'll show some methods specifically for dealing with those. And throughout, we're going to use deep learning. So I'll give a very brief introduction to classical neural networks, but also modern transformers, and we'll show some results on a simulated data set. Okay, so let's start off with what are embeddings that I've been referring to. So as you know, pricing depends a lot on categorical variables. Most pricing data sets come with a large number of categorical variables in addition to numerical or continuous variables. And then for some reason, pricing actuaries really like pre-processing continuous variables into categorical ones. And probably the root cause of that is a particular software package is highly optimized to fit GLMs quickly when you've got categorical variables. So that's why the practice seems to have evolved from there, that we don't really like to put continuous variables into our models, even though you could. And the simulated data set that we'll be using throughout this talk as an example, you can see a snapshot of the first and last rows in here. So you can see there's about 200,000 lines of data. We've assumed that the exposure is one for all of these. And you can see there's a good mixture of categorical variables as well as numerical variables like vehicle power and vehicle weight. And then you'll see three very detailed categorical columns towards the right-hand part of the slide. This represents vehicle brand, vehicle model, and then a detailed vehicle model field. And finally, because this is a simulated data set, we have got the great advantage of knowing the true frequency of claim, because that's been set by us, and we'll be able to demonstrate how well these models work against something where we know the actual correct outcome. So bearing that in mind, I want to talk a little bit about GLMs. And What I'd like to make a statement and then explain is that GLMs with factor levels is pretty much the same as a one-dimensional embedding. And let's unpack that. So often when we're doing pricing in short-term insurance, we use GLMs, and these have an explicit linear model form on the scale of the link function. So what that means is you've chosen an appropriate link function. Often we like using multiplicative models, so we choose the log function. And after transforming your equation appropriately, you can see that we've just got a simple linear regression. Now, let's suppose that your first variable, in this case, x1, is a categorical variable. It was maybe numerical and was binned. And that means we can represent the GLM as this sort of step function. And the step function basically says you've got one covariate, which is beta 1, and that is for the first variable in this equation, and basically it's got Q1 levels. So in other words, every time you change your value of X1 from 1 to 2, you just are going to put in a different categorical variable. So what does that mean? As you vary the first variable going into your GLM, the GLM value will change on the scale of the link function by beta 1, 2, minus beta 1, 1. So it's just the difference between these coefficients. And what's important to say is that when you fit a GLM, these beta coefficients are learned directly from your data. And this sort of idea where you are learning a coefficient directly from your data, that's exactly what's called an embedding in the deep learning literature. So with a little bit more accuracy, beta 1 and all of the levels of beta 1 represent a one-dimensional embedding, which we can then generalize things to much higher dimensions. So you might land up with attributing a five-dimensional vector to each level instead of a single variable. But the reason I wanted to start with this introduction, just everyone in the room who's done some pricing has actually worked with a embedding before, and it's just what we call what's fit by a GLM on categorical data. So let's give a very simple example. So here we fit a GLM on the synthetic data set, and we've pre-processed our driver age information to not be numerical. This is R code, and you can see we're treating it as categorical, and we're simply plotting the coefficients on the bottom right-hand part of the slide. And what you can see is we have got learned a series of coefficients. It starts at 18. Younger drivers tend to have worse experience. Middle-aged drivers tend to have low experience, and then that unfortunately goes up a little bit with age. So what we've produced here are GLM coefficients, which you can either call your factor levels or your pricing relativities, or if you want to adopt the language of deep learning, this is what you'd call a 1D embedding. And since the output of this GLM should be frequency, because we try to fit the actual known frequencies in this column of the data file, with this GLM, you can directly interpret the coefficients on the frequency scale. And as I said before, in this case, we treated age as a categorical variable, whereas we could have also done this as a continuous variable, and then you would have received only one coefficient, and that's much more like a linear regression we do in statistics, where you might have a coefficient multiplied by the actual age. And what we're going to be doing in this talk is generalizing this to be working with deep learning models and much higher dimensional embeddings. So normally what happens is that we don't actually know the true rates, if you think about 99% of your pricing exercises that you ever do. So in that case, what you're going to try to do is approximate things from very noisy experience. And this is another GLM that we fit in R. Here, instead of fitting on the true rates like we did before, we're taking our actual simulated claims. So claims are simulated using a Poisson distribution. And what we've done is effectively derive exactly the same coefficients before. And in this plot on the bottom right-hand part of the slide, what you can see is that we actually have very little exposure in some of the buckets. So, for example, at younger ages and older ages, we only have very few observations. And what's very, very interesting is that even in this simple simulated example, you can already start to see the noise that's been induced in the coefficients that we fit with our GLMs. You can see we've got a truly ridiculous frequency of 0.8 at the oldest ages, where we've got very little frequency. So most actuaries will say this doesn't have good credibility, and it doesn't. So what you might want to do is smooth your rates out, and we'll look at a quick example of that in just a bit. Or you might want to apply regularization, which is the main theme of the paper, and we'll be connecting that idea to credibility. Another thing you can do is try to smooth this out by hand. So this is very manual and time consuming and depends a lot on your expert judgment, which may or may not be appropriate. So let's just talk about the two types of embedding. So what we've been presenting to this point is where we've binned continuous data. And you can see this on the graph. And this embedding where you've got a numerical data that you've binned, these have a natural order. So what you can do is you can smooth over some of the dimensions of these embeddings or these factor levels. And what's very natural to try to do is try smooth over the age dimension over here. So this is an example from a project that I presented at ASA last year called ICENET. And this is where on a different data set, what you can do is you can fit a 1D embedding or a categorical variable in a GLM. And this was for driver age. You can do things like apply the fused lasso, which fuses different levels of your factor levels together. So you get something that looks like what you see in the middle part of the slide. Or you can apply smoothing, just like our colleagues in life insurance do. And you can see that you get this very nice smooth sort of set of relativities, which I guess may or may not be appropriate for pricing. Categorical data, on the other hand, doesn't have this natural ordering by, say, an age dimension or a vehicle power dimension. And this means that we have to think about other approaches, which are usually going to be similar to credibility theory in some way. And we'll make that connection in just a little bit. So this is really serving as a bit of an introduction. What is an embedding? And just to remind everyone a little bit of the theory of GLMs and how you can fit these. What I'm now going to do is talk a bit about deep learning, because these are the tools that we're going to use in the rest of this discussion today. So probably the most important thing to remember is every time you see a deep neural network, all it is a fancy GLM. So in what way is it a fancy GLM? If you look at the diagram on the right-hand part of the screen, the way to read these neural network diagrams is circles or variables, and lines represent regression coefficients. And if you just concentrate on the very right-hand part of the slide with the green box, you'll see that you've got a bunch of variables all connected to a single output variable. And that's how you represent a linear model in neural network diagram conventions. And then on top of that, if you look at the other parts of this diagram, you've got what we're calling a feature extractor. So the way that this works is you feed in your input variables. It might be driver age, vehicle type, suburb, postal code, etc. And you're going to process these into a new representation using this deep neural network. And once you've got that new representation, all you're doing is fitting a GLM on top of it. So really what the key message from this slide is that everyone who's ever used a GLM for actuarial work is one step away from applying deep learning. And it's not a whole new paradigm of how models work like you have with gradient boosting machines. Okay, and this is just another quick view of embedding layers. So often the way that we incorporate categorical data into our models is with something called one-hot encoding. This is what happens in R when you fit a GLM. Something very similar to this is what happens in R when you fit a GLM with categorical data. And I've just done a bit of a tongue-in-cheek view of what are the abilities of different people you might encounter in a short-term insurance environment, what are their abilities across finance, math, statistics, and liabilities. And really what we're trying to show is that an embedding layer is going to give you this multi-dimensional vector of real numbers that you then use to represent each category in your deep learning models. What's really interesting is that modern machine learning, and by this all the way from computer vision but to the large language models that are now occupying a lot of people's attention, all of modern machine learning relies on embeddings, this concept of a multidimensional vector that represents a category. There's a very famous paper called Attention is All You Need, and where the original, this is where the original explanation of the transformer model is found. And I think anyone who's used a large language model will know ChatGPT, and you can see the screenshot on the bottom right-hand part of the slide. ChatGPT is a form of pre-trained transformer model. And at its basis, the main idea of how these models work is you have embeddings for natural language, and you apply this thing called a transformer model on top of them. Embeddings, I suppose, have got a long and varied and rich history in the past 10 years of the machine learning literature. They do very interesting things when you apply them to natural language. So on the bottom left-hand part of the slide, this is from the Word to VEC paper. And what you can see is that they fit a whole bunch of embeddings on natural language data and then try to visualize what had been done by the model in a simple two-dimensional space. And what you can see from here is on the left-hand part of this exhibit on the bottom left-hand part of the slide is you've got a bunch of country names. And then on the right-hand part of the slide, you've got the capitals of those countries. And you get this very nice semantic interpretation of embeddings that have been trained in this way, particularly when you're using transformer models. So how do transformers work? There's this concept of attention. So let's think of a GLM, which is a classic actuarial model. Generally, when we fit a GLM, you get a static or fixed relationship between your covariates. So for example, you might say if someone is male and young, they've got a 15 or 20% chance of a higher claim than someone who isn't male and young. More flexible models are enabled by this concept of attention. And a nice way of demonstrating exactly what this core component of a transformer model is on the bottom part of the slide. This is an example where people were trying to get machine learning models to label pictures. So let's look at this one on the right-hand side. It says a stop sign is on a road with a mountain in the background. How did the machine learning model come up with that annotation? Basically, you've got a picture of a stop street, just a stop sign just above it, and you can see that the model's attention is focused all around that stop sign. And that's exactly what attention does. It kind of focuses the attention of the model where it counts, and this is really the underlying mechanism that exists in large pre-trained transformer models to work with embeddings and come up with very flexible but predictive models. Some other intuitions on how self-attention works. So self-attention is the correct technical name for the attention that's applied in transformer models. As we've said, when we build our actuarial models, we might have fixed relationships between covariates and outcomes, but in truth, those relationships might depend on the context. So the famous example that I've mentioned before is that both young drivers and male drivers, when you have young male drivers, you'll have increased frequency. And what you need to do to capture that is allow for an interaction effect. What self-attention does is it can focus in on other variables that you have in your model and automatically create those sorts of interaction effects. So here's another very nice example of a visualization of attention. And the way this works is you're feeding in a sentence that reads the FBI is chasing a criminal on the run. And the model just gets to see the first word, then the second word, then the third word, etc. And you can see that as you fed more and more of this sentence into your model, that the self-attention represented by this blue coloring focuses on different parts of the word. So if you look at the bottom of this little exhibit in the middle part of the slide and the bottom sentence, you can see the word run is highlighting criminal and chasing. And again, that gives you some intuition for how self-attention focuses itself on the right part of a model. So let me give a quick actuarial example of embeddings and transformer models. This was a project that we did on severity data from the National Flood Insurance Program in the United States. And what we were trying to do is predict a damage ratio, which very similar to a severity model, using several continuous and categorical covariates. And all the categorical covariates we used embeddings for, and you can see in the graph on the right-hand part of the slide, as you move from the on the x-axis from the left to the right, that represents the different values of the categorical covariate. But what applying a transformer model on top of this allows you to do is to allow the value to vary depending on other covariates that you have in this model. So because we were dealing with flood, and one of the variables in this data set was what sort of basement do you have on the house? And you can see that unfinished basements lead to lower values of this particular embedding, whereas subgrade basements in blue lead to higher values of the embedding. And this is a nice example of exactly how embeddings and attention work to give you contextualized relationships in your data set. Okay, so what have we discussed to this point? We've spoken about embeddings and what they do, and also we've spoken about how you can process these embeddings with transformer models. So now let's take the next step to getting towards this method of dealing with high cardinality categorical variables by talking about generalized linear mixed models. So what can go wrong with embeddings? So you might have a lot of categorical variables where there's few examples of each level. And let's say you're dealing with car vehicle brand, model, and variance. And what you'll often find is you might have lots of Toyotas in your data sets. And I hope I'm pronouncing this right, but you may have very few Abarths. I don't even know how to say that. Does anyone in the audience can perhaps guide my pronunciation here? But this is something that pops up in a data set once in a while. It's a very rare type of car brand. And what happens is when you've got very little exposure, you're going to get very noisy data generated by your claims process. So let's just look at an example of this from our synthetic data. On the bottom part of the slide, we've got our simulated data, and each panel reflects respectively the brand of the vehicle we're talking about, the model of the vehicle we're talking about, and then the detail. So this might be Toyota, Corolla, and I can't actually think of a Corolla model right now, but I'm sure someone in the audience can help us. And what you can see is that under vehicle brands, you'll have probably a lot of exposure, and your true predicted, your true frequency and your observed frequency are going to lie very close to each other within a reasonable confidence band. As we move to the right of this picture, you can see vehicle models, you have less exposure, so things get much noisier until you get to vehicle details. And here you can see that naively applying a GLM or anything that's going to try get signal out of this noisy data is going to give you dramatically incorrect and wrong coefficients. And this is really what the problem of when you have high cardinality categorical variables and you try to fit a GLM or you try to fit an embedding, you get extremely noisy outcomes. And that's exactly why we need to use some sort of credibility thinking. So what is a classic credibility approach over here? What you might think you should do is derive a credibility coefficient, which I've represented by beta credibility. And you might have a credibility factor Z that you want to multiply through by the mean of your portfolio. And then 1 minus Z, which is the complement of credibility, you might want to multiply by what you've actually pulled directly out of your model. So that would be beta I. And a very nice way of doing this is something called a GLMM. This is a generalized linear mixed model. And these incorporate Bullman-Straub credibility principles to pull individual coefficients towards a portfolio mean. And this is actually a very happy accident. The first time I saw this, I almost... my jaw almost hit the table, that in a completely different branch of statistics from actuarial science, you've got a model that is effectively relying on the Bullman-Straub credibility model. So what does this look like? Again, we're going to fit these two vehicle details, which we saw, the true versus the observed on the bottom right-hand part of the slide. The dots in red represent your GLM coefficient. And your dots in blue represent your generalized linear mixed model coefficients. And we've ranked this by the amount of exposure on the x-axis. So the actual numerical value of exposure is on the plot on the bottom right-hand part of the slide. And let's just see what's happened over here. So what you can see is if we look at the red dots on the bottom left-hand part of the slide, these coefficients are all over and things get wilder and wilder as we have very little exposure. But what the GLMM does is it almost reproduces the GLM for very high exposure and then pulls things towards the portfolio mean as we get to places with low exposure. And that's exactly the sort of credibility principle that we'd expect from an actuarial perspective, where you've got lots of credibility or lots of exposure, you want to trust what the data says. And where you have got very little exposure, what you ideally want to do is not trust the data so much and go more towards the portfolio mean. And generalized linear mixed models offer exactly that solution to this problem of high cardinality data that we've been speaking about. So why do we call this a generalized linear mixed model? So GLMMs can include normal regression coefficients, just like you have in your normal GLM. And these don't get a credibility treatment. So these are called fixed effects. And then in addition, you can also have coefficients in a GLMM that do get a credibility treatment. And because you can derive credibility treatments using statistical models, some of the terminology that you find out there in the statistics literature is These are called random effects. So mixing the two together, you get what's called a mixed model. So if this interests you, this is a very, very nice paper by Fred Klinker from the CAS on how to introduce credibility into GLMs through GLMMs. And it's definitely an interesting read. What are some of the disadvantages of this GLMM framework? So it can be very slow to fit these models, especially if you've got a complex GLM like we might have in a pricing context. It's probably a waste of time to even try it, and they may not always converge, and that can be a little bit frustrating. But the question I'd like to stop this section of the presentation on is, how can we incorporate this similar idea of applying a credibility treatment to learned coefficients or learned embeddings? How can we incorporate that into deep neural networks? And that's what the next two sections of this talk are going to be about. I can't actually see if there's any questions yet. I'm very happy to take questions now or at the end. Perhaps the person who kindly introduced me could mention if they are, but I'm also happy to carry on. Okay.
No questions.
Okay. So let's now think wearing a bit of a Bayesian hat and understand how we can start to move this into a neural network framework. So we've got what you would generally see if in an introductory talk on Bayesian thinking, a very colorful graph on the right-hand part of the slide, and I'll try to go through this in just a bit. But the basic idea is what you want to do when you have a Bayesian model is come up with a prior distribution that's shown in blue on the graph on the right-hand part of the screen. And what we've done is we've chosen a normal distribution centered at zero. And then what you'll have is your actual observed distribution of your data or of your coefficients, and that's shown in the green distribution, and that might have a mean, say, of 1 or 2. And then what Bayesian Bayes theorem does for you is it gives you the posterior distribution that lies somewhere between your prior and your data likelihood, and that's represented in orange. And what you can see is happening in this particular example is that we're pulling coefficients out of their actual distribution, which is green, towards the blue distribution, which is your prior distribution centered at zero. And what that's going to do is shrink or squish down the coefficients that you're generating by fitting your GLM or fitting your neural network model. And what you can do is you can also fit GLMMs using these sorts of Bayesian methods. But the biggest problem is that these are too slow for complex models such as neural networks. You might have a closed form solution like the Bullman-Straub credibility formula, but unfortunately, that's only available in simple cases. So building towards our use case that we're discussing here, which is incorporating this into neural networks, I'm going to give a very brief introduction to how you can approximate this Bayesian approach. And there's two things, MAP, which is maximum a posteriori estimation, and it sounds very fancy, but actually it's not, and then variational inference. So let's have a look at MAP estimation. And the way MAP estimation basically works is you have your prior distribution. You can see in this diagram that it's centered at zero. And what you do is you force the means of your coefficients that you've derived towards that prior mean. And that basically just tries to get you to the prior. There's actually nothing much more to it than that. For those of you who've done some machine learning in the room, you'll know this is equivalent to ridge regularization, where you have L2 regularization. And I'm just making that comment in case you've come across it before. If you haven't, you can ignore the comment. But basically, all we're trying to do is include some sort of term in our neural network optimization that pushes your coefficients towards zero. And if you look at the formula on the middle part of the slide, don't worry about everything until the very last term. All we're trying to do is penalize our coefficients, which are represented by U. And what we want to do is regularize them or penalize them with a strength that's inversely proportional to your exposure. So that means if you've got low exposure, you need more regularization. And this is just another way of expressing what I said a little bit earlier in the slides, that what we're trying to do is emulate this behavior of a generalized linear mixed model, that when you have low exposure, you push it very much towards the group mean. What's very nice about this is it's actually very easy to program this into a deep learning framework like Keras. And actually, all you need to do is just make the choice, do you want to have regularization or not? And if you want to dive a little bit more deeply into how to do this, it's available in the code. That's one paradigm of doing this sort of estimation. The other one is something called variational inference. And if you've used any of these nice image generating tools like DALL-E 3 or Midjourney, all of these have got some sort of variational autoencoder inside them. And the way that the variational inference works is a little bit different from normal Bayesian methods. Normal Bayesian methods, you say, let's assume that we believe everything comes from your prior distribution. You have your data likelihood, and then you push that towards the prior. The way this works in variational inference is you do something different. You say, let's assume our posterior follows a particular distribution. In this case, let's assume it follows a Gaussian with a mean of zero. And let's just push your coefficients to almost more likely be drawn from that prior. So basically, it forces the coefficients to, pushes your coefficients to be drawn from that posterior. So what it does is it forces your coefficients to follow your chosen posterior. And the way that makes sense, and this is probably the most Bayesian statement I'll make the whole day, is that if you have a Gaussian prior and a Gaussian likelihood, you know from our statistics theory that that gives you a Gaussian posterior. So basically all that this does is if you assume your data will be distributed like a normal distribution, and you force that towards another normal distribution, you're effectively doing exactly what Bayesian estimation would like you to do. Let's put it all together now, and now we can start looking at some results after getting all the theory out the way. The one step is we've said embeddings can be used to capture complex, high-dimensional information about categorical data, but these have the risk that we overfit to the noise in the data, particularly when there's high cardinality and observations with little exposure. So what we've developed and been working towards is Bayesian methods to credibility weight the embeddings towards zero, depending on the amount of exposure. And now what we're going to do is just incorporate these random effects embeddings into your deep neural network. So in the diagram on the right-hand part of the slide, we've got a deep neural network. On the left-hand part of the slide, we've got two types of embeddings. We've got our continuous covariates, and then we've got categorical covariates that we've applied this Bayesian treatment to. You push these into a deep neural network, and you're going to get your output. So let's have a look at some results. So remember that we know the true frequency of claim from our simulated data set. On the right-hand part of the slide, I'm showing what is the true rate of claim. What do you observe directly from the data set and a confidence interval for three variables? Driver age, you can see everything is pretty close. Vehicle age gets a little bit funny with the older vehicles. And then vehicle details, you can see, is completely wrong. And then what we've done is we fit a basic neural network with embeddings to this data. Another approach, which I'm not going to go into too much detail, called GLMM-Net, and also LightGBM, which is gradient boosted trees. And what we're looking at is some measure of goodness of fit to the true observed data. And in this particular instance, a lower number is better. And let's just see what happens if you only use the mean to predict. You get a very high number indicating the model isn't fitting well. If you ignore categorical covariates, which in this instance contain a lot of data, your best performing model is a neural network. And now what we do is we start adding these noisy covariates like vehicle brand, model, and detail. And you can see that the performance improves, but actually as you include more and more detail, your neural network starts to suffer quite a lot, as does your other neural network example. LightGBM actually does very well with all of the data, but with vehicle detail. Now what we're going to do is add this Bayesian irregularization to the neural network. And you can see a dramatic improvement when you start regularizing. So let's just, for the purpose of time, skip to the bottom part of the table on the slide. And in that case, with variational Bayesian regularization, with all of the categorical covariates, you can see that this model, this network that we've been proposing, is dramatically improved compared to LightGBM or a neural network without it. So what's the message of this slide? Applying some of these methods, particularly map regularization, which is very easy to do, actually produces fantastic results if you've got some signal in otherwise very noisy categorical data. And let's have a look at what are the embeddings. So what we've tried to do is have more regularization when your exposures are low. And what that means is you should have smaller values of your embedding weights for lower exposure. So what we're showing are the embedding weights produced using map regularized embeddings. for the different categorical covariates. And if we start on the bottom of the slide, you can see, let's focus on the panel on the bottom left-hand side. What we've got on the x-axis are your exposures or your case weights, and then you've got the size of the embedding on the y-axis. And you can see this relationship where low case weights leads to small values of your embedding. And as you start having more exposure, which is as you go from the left to the right on the slide, you start allowing your embedding values to get much bigger. In other words, give more credibility and stop shrinking towards zero. If you now look on the top part of the slide, you will see that we've got the embeddings for brand, model, and detail. And you can see that the colors are the same in the top panels and the bottom panel. So red represents low exposure. And generally, the red values cluster very much around the 0, 0 point. In other words, we're not giving much weight or allowing the embeddings to expand away from zero if they don't have much exposure. But when the embeddings do have lots of exposure, like the dots in blue, we're allowing that distribution to expand. And that's really exactly what we said before. When you've got high credibility, you'll give weight to what the data says. A final step before I stop and try to take some questions is, what can we do if there's a natural hierarchy in your data? So let's think about this a little bit. What we've done before is we've treated your embeddings representing make, model, and variance completely independently. But we know that we have a hierarchical structure. You can't have a Toyota Corolla from Ford because Ford doesn't make Corollas as far as I know. So how can we exploit this known structure and the sort of hierarchical structure we've got is shown in the tree on the right-hand part of the slide. And obviously, as we've said, the complexity here is the exposure of your lowest level of the hierarchy can be extremely sparse. And a good way to think about this and the assumption that we make in this work that we're presenting here is that you can model the incremental information added in each level. So what that means is you can assume that each level of the hierarchy and the change in the embedding that you get at each level of the hierarchy is conditionally independent of the previous level. So I hope I'm not bringing back statistics nightmares to anyone, but this is called Markov conditional independence. And how can we build some models for these hierarchical embeddings? One option is you could just put the embeddings for each level of the hierarchy into the model. And that's actually exactly what we've just done above. We didn't exploit any hierarchical structure. Another thing you could do is you could add the embeddings up. So let's say you've got an embedding for brand, for model, and variant. You could just add those together. And this gives you a very nice compact representation that goes into your network. Or if you want to exploit the time series, you could view this as a time series, which is starting at the top, going to one level down, and going another level down. You can apply more advanced neural networks. So I'm not going to talk too much about recurrent neural networks, but what you can do is you can apply those, or you can simply apply a transformer model over the embeddings at each level of the hierarchy. And what the main idea is that you can allow your neural network to learn the dependencies over the hierarchy, and that the information that this network learns can then be shared among the embeddings and then pushed into making your predictions. So in the bottom right-hand part of the slide, we've got an example very similar to what we saw before. You may have a hierarchy now of these random effect embeddings or the embeddings that have been regularized using a credibility principle. We're going to feed these into a recurrent neural network and join the outputs of that recurrent neural network or transformer together with your other variables, push it through a deep neural network and look at the outputs. And following exactly this process, we're going to present some results on this slide. So we only fit the models using map regularization because the previous results showed variational inference is a little bit better, but it's a lot more complex, so we actually didn't bother. And what the results show, if you again look towards the bottom of the table, where we've got the results from the transformer model, you can in fact see that we've improved even on the non-hierarchical model. So on the non-hierarchical model, we had a score of 0.1446. And if you look in the bottom left-hand part of the table, you can see that the transformer layer is much better than that. And we've also added root mean square error, which gives the same message, as well as mean absolute error. And just to show a very simple example of how these embeddings evolve in the simple model that we call the H1 model, where you just add the embeddings at each level of the hierarchy together, you can see that they behave almost as expected. As you add more detail, the embeddings tend to cluster around that center point if they don't have enough credibility. But if they do have credibility, then they start to expand into different parts of this embedding space. Let's just summarize what we've discussed here today. So we've said high cardinality categorical variables can pose a significant challenge in regression modeling, particularly if we want to do pricing. Entity embedding combined with regularization, which you can think of as credibility, gives a very powerful solution to handle these variables. We've explored two main approaches to doing this in complex neural network models: map estimation and variational Bayesian inference. And we've also shown how hierarchical structures in your categorical variables can be leveraged to further improve model performance. And one conclusion is that recurrent neural networks and transformer architectures show a lot of promise in processing this hierarchical data. So drawing some conclusions, regularization of high cardinality embeddings can significantly improve your model performance. The choice of regularization is maybe less important than actually just deciding to apply regularization. Good idea to leverage a hierarchy in categorical variables if you can find one. And transformer models work really well. Something I haven't written here is that map estimation is really simple to do. And if you want some inspiration, you can look at the code we gave in the link to in the beginning of this talk, and maybe just some directions for where we should go with this from a research perspective. So how do these hierarchical regularized embeddings work with other machine learning techniques like gradient boosting? We just assume simple Gaussian prior is centered at zero. Maybe there's other ways of doing this to incorporate domain knowledge of external data. It might be very interesting to do adaptive regularization that adjusts the strength of your regularization based on data characteristics. And for the convention, we'll hopefully show a paper that does something similar to that in the life insurance space. And you might also want to consider the potential of pre-training these embeddings and then transferring them into different models. And with that, I'm going to stop and hand back to our chair of the session. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Ron. There are a couple of questions there.
Hi, Ron. Excuse me. Thank you very much for that. That was very interesting. My question comes from the age-old problem with categorical variables, which is the inability to smooth and how results can be quite, they can be very jumpy. So if we think of area, you could have a lot of exposure in one area and have a good rate, you move two streets to the right, and your rate jumps 20 or 30%. Is there a way that we can deal with that in the methods you're suggesting? And also, is there a world in which, because obviously this all, it, with lack of exposure, goes closer to the mean. Is there a way in which we can use the hierarchical structure to go closer to a more exposure-weighted mean? So out of an example, so say we have a Toyota as a high exposure, like level one of the hierarchy compared to Fortuna 2014, but then you get a maybe an older model that goes closer to the Toyota mean rather than the entire dataset's mean. Is there a world in which we have different weights pulling it back to different means, I suppose?
Sure. So maybe you could just put the slides up again, and I'll try to answer both questions. So the slide, I can kind of see myself in. Okay, there we go. What's interesting about when you think about things spatially is it's just a generalization of a 2D numerical data that's been binned, right? So here we're showing how you can smooth over one dimension. For area data where you need to have a sensible geospatial relationship between your variables, you just need to smooth over two dimensions. So you could easily apply a ISNET approach that I showed at the convention, or even this stuff that I'm showing on this slide across two dimensions. And it's a trivial generalization. And then I think exactly the question you're asking about what happens when you've got very low exposure, this is exactly what we're trying to solve over here. So when you think about regularization, let's say in the lowest level of this tree, you've actually got a node with low exposure. All it's going to do is regularize you to the model and then regularize you to the brand. So exactly what you said is going to happen, right? Let's say you've got very low exposure on a particular vehicle detail on the, if you look at the plot on the bottom right-hand part of the slide, all that's going to mean is you'll get an overall Toyota Corolla, but you won't get the 2015 version coming through. So exactly what you're mentioning is what this method is trying to solve for. I hope that helps or answers the question.
Thank you very much. Hi, Ron. I just have two questions. The first one was the data that you tested on now. I'm assuming that was personalized data. So then my second part of the question would be, what would be different if you had to apply these methods to the commercial space? And would there be any different challenges or any larger challenges if we had to do this in the commercial space?
I mean, if you just look at the Bullman-Straub formula over here, a linear credibility model, all that's going to happen is Z is going to be bigger and 1 minus Z is going to be smaller. The other thing is probably you might have significantly less rich data, which might make building a predictive model a bit of a futile exercise. But other than that, the only difference is going to be the size of Z, in my view. And I'd love to hear anyone else's views, but that's what my intuition would tell me.
Hi, Ron. David Kirk here. Thanks for the presentation. Got a couple of questions. You started off by seemingly throwing shade at Actree's binning continuous data. But nothing in your work has suggested you wouldn't want to do that, and where there isn't a linear relationship with that continuous variable, binning is still a good idea, so I don't want to check that. You sort of seem to be on the attack, but then you left it.
What's interesting is, I guess what I'm saying is, why do we do that? There's very easy ways of incorporating continuous variables into GLMs using splines, for example, which are, respect automatically the spatial dimension of your data or the numerical dimension of your data. So even on something as simple as this, David, let's just go back to this example, right? You're going to put, continuous data, and then you're just going to have noise to deal with. Whereas if you just fit a spline, or you maybe fit a quadratic or a higher order polynomial term, you'll fit this perfectly. So I think the practice of binning continuous data is, I think it's something we should think about. Of course you can do it, and of course you'll get good results, particularly if you're smooth, but do we really need to do it is the question I'm trying to ask.
Explain that is, you're not suggesting not adjusting it, you're suggesting alternative approaches. Okay, thank you. And then on the prior estimate, you spoke about using a Gaussian thing centered on zero. Didn't talk that much about choosing the variance for that distribution to have an impact. So maybe you could chat a bit more about that. And then if you take this natural Bayesian thinking further, presumably the next time you run the models, wouldn't necessarily want to take zero as your prior. You could presumably, in fact, take the prior estimates and then the prior posterior distribution.
Brilliant. So on the first question, for MAP in particular, standard deviation doesn't make a difference. It only makes a difference if you want to do a second order approximation like the Laplace distribution to this Gaussian. But for MAP, which is just a first order approximation to the full Bayesian procedure, you don't actually need standard deviation. I've kind of brushed over this in variational inference, and this gets a lot more complex. Here, what you'll assume in your Gaussian posterior, generally you make the assumption of mean zero, variance one, and then you just force everything to match that variance. But remember, because you've got such a flexible architecture, so if you think about where the embeddings are going into, you'll just compensate if you get the variance distribution wrong with these coefficients. So that's the technically correct answer to your first question. Just remind me what the second question was, please, David.
It's about the ability to use your posterior from the prior model run.
Brilliant idea. So yeah, if you want to have a second round of a posteriori fitting, you can just set these priors based on your previous coefficients. Much easier to do that is you actually just keep the embedding weights and initialize all of this at what you had last time, and you just train it a little bit on your new data. And that will do almost exactly what you're referring to.
Thanks, Ron. I think after a brilliant idea, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
I would expect nothing less from you, David.
Thanks, Ron. I saw you were comparing on when you're like looking at hierarchical variables. You're looking at, I think, RNNs as well as transformers doing better there. I guess maybe it's because both work on order. But what I wanted to understand is, why is transformer better? Is it mainly because of the attention, the self-attention that you were sort of taking us through at the start?
Yeah. I think it's a really, really good question. I think recurrent neural networks are just hard to optimize, and they suffer from the vanishing gradient problem. So by the time you do your fitting, which goes backwards through this network, it's just too complex. Whereas transformers, which effectively compose together parallel layers but don't have this recurrence, just are easier to optimize. And probably that's the root cause of why no one really thinks about recurrent neural networks anymore. And they're only making almost a little bit of a comeback with new models based on state space thinking. But just because transformer models are much easier to optimize is why I think you get these slightly better results that you mentioned over here. Also, transformer layers are faster. And if you care about speed of inference or speed of training, you can run transformers on GPUs, whereas recurrent neural networks have only got very limited GPU implementations, and no one cares about it anymore because everything is transformers now. Probably, as we said, just because it's easier to optimize.
Online question.
The one question is, would it not make more sense to group vehicle details with similar frequency severity rather than the vehicle make?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
Would it not make more sense to group vehicle details with similar frequency and severity rather than with the vehicle make?
Oh, yeah, you could do that, but then you lose the nice thing about the hierarchy. And I think you'll get more gain on your model performance by doing it with the way we've shown here than just by grouping in the frequency space. Because remember, maybe another point just to make to ever ask that question is, you want this nice 2D space, because remember, you're not making predictions directly from these embeddings. They're still going through a neural network. Whereas if you want to group in the frequency space, you'll lose a lot of the extra information you've got. Perhaps the person who asked the question should also think about target encoding and the relative advantage of target encoding versus categorical encoding that we're doing here. But I think it's a very interesting question.
Thanks, Ron. And the other online question is, if the model pulls the coefficients for low exposure vehicle details towards the vehicle make, will there not be underestimation if the frequency or severity for these vehicle details significantly exceeds that of the vehicle make mean?
So I guess they could be saying, would your model start to predict wrong for all the other variables? And I guess I'd say coming in over or under is a weakness of any machine learning model. And there's ways of sorting it out, like the balance property regularization from Mario Wittrich, or just recalibrating the last layer of a neural network. So they have a point, but it's something that can quite easily be corrected.
Okay, thank you very much, Ron. We really appreciate your time and for presenting today. Always grateful for your presentations and all the research you do.